Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today and next week is a lady we're calling Gabby Girl. Gabby's a friend for Bonnie and me, and back in the 1980s, she was a private investigator who sometimes worked for Oscar Goodman, who was a mob lawyer at the time. As he fought to keep the mobsters out of jail, frequently successfully, Gabby has lots of stories from way back when. For our listeners who believe that if we're not talking about gambling, then they don't want to listen, before we get to Gabby Girl, Richard and I are going to open up our mailbox and answer some of your emails. Before we do that, recently, Richard announced that the guy who prepared a log for our show quit and we could use another volunteer if there was one out there. Richard, how is that search going?
Well, surprisingly well. We filled the post almost immediately, and so I'm very thankful for that, and I'm thankful for the other people who volunteered. I think we had four or five different people volunteer. So I thank you for that, and this is a, you know, kind of a thankless job, so I don't know how long a person can do this without getting sort of fed up with it. So we may ask again sometime in the future, but anyway, so I just wanted to thank all of the volunteers for that, for the show notes. And in the past, the show notes do not always go up at the same time as the show. Sometimes there was a delay of, you know, sometimes a week or even more. But currently they are going up with the show, but that's because we're recording the shows ahead of time, so we're able to do that. But anyway, the show notes will be there. The links will be there. And again, thanks to all the volunteers. I also have a brief story this week. I went to... My wife and I and my son and his girlfriend, we went to the movies at the Palms, and something I didn't realize, you probably did, but you can't pay for movies with your comp points at the Palms. The movie theater is separate. But anyway, that aside.
So you had to pay real cash money in a casino? Did that irritate you?
No, it wasn't so bad, but... After the movie, we went to the buffet, which I think is quite good, and we were standing in line at the buffet, and a guy behind us said, "Do you have a player's card?" And it was a young guy with his wife or girlfriend, and I said, "Yeah," and he said, "Do you want a coupon for half off?" And I said, "Sure," and he gave me a coupon, and it was from the Las Vegas Advisor. And so I thanked him. I guess he had two of them, you know, it saved us $32. And I thought, wow, this was...
Paid for the movie.
Yeah, yeah. So, no, more than paid for the movie. I just thought, for those people who don't realize that those coupons really are worth some money. And so I thank that person who had no idea who I was. And if he's a listener out there, thank you very much for handing me that coupon.
Oh, he would have recognized your voice.
Maybe. Probably.
All right. Let's get to some questions from our listeners. First question, why would a sports book bar a player who wins too much? I'm going to try this one first. And the short and sweet answer to that is that the manager of the sports book has his head up his ass. A really, really good sports bettor has an advantage of maybe 3% on average, usually less. It would be beneficial to that book to use a sharp player as an information source. That is, if I were such a good bettor, and I'm not, and I come in and bet $50,000 on the Cowboy, which is never going to happen, the book would know that the line he was offering was out of whack favoring the Cowboys. So he'd move the point, he'd move the line a point or so against the boys simply because of the information that this smart bettor was making on the big play. A book might limit the exposure to such a player, perhaps 50,000 aside on NFL games, something like that. And the book has to be wary of feints by the players, such as me coming in and betting $10,000 on the Cowboys, having the book move the line by a point, and then betting 50 $100,000 on the other side, which presumably was my real goal all along. A book that kicks out players for winning too much is simply short-sighted and not using some very strong and inexpensive information it could be using. Richard, any thoughts on this?
Well, just within the last week or two, there was an article. Well, I'm not sure when this episode is coming out, but an ESPN, David Purdom, just wrote an article about how many players William Hill is kicking out. And he picked William Hill because they are kind of spreading across the country as legal sports betting is spreading to other states. And I guess he was not aware of how much good players are getting kicked out. What they don't realize is that they're kicking out a lot of bad players. And because these are corporations, you know, no one ever lost their job for kicking out players. So they are going to just continue to kick out anybody they think might have a chance of winning and protect their jobs. You know, Pinnacle would takes action from anybody and everybody. So you're right.
And they have the best lines, and the best line defined as the smallest difference between betting on one side and betting on the other. These are really sharp lines they have.
Yeah, yeah. So, and they'll take a position. You know, if the money comes in strongly on one side that they think is wrong, they're not going to move the line just to balance their book. They will take a position. So, anyway, yeah, I mean, the short answer is casinos are stupid.
All right. Second question. Can you provide some hints on how to scout table games without being too obvious about it? Richard, this one's all yours.
Well, if you are scouting table games, I would think that you would see somebody else scouting table games, and they would often be very easy to spot. So the short answer is, don't do what those people are doing. You know, one of the things that I thought was really effective back in the days when you put coins in slot machines was I saw a guy scouting table games carrying a bucket of quarters.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, you know, that's a really great idea. That guy looks like an idiot, you know. So I think you just have to try to look like the other casino patrons. A lot of casino patrons go and watch people play table games. So you have to just sort of not do it like it's your job, you know? I mean, you know what that looks like. So do what the other tourists are doing and be able to scout at the same time.
Do you dress differently when you're scouting than when you're playing? Is that a secret information?
No, because you never know when you're going to see something and want to sit down and play. So, so no, I wouldn't say that. I think it's more about how focused you are. I mean, there are some of these people who scout, and they walk up to a table, they wait for the dealer to deliver their card, and then immediately go to the next table and look at the dealer deliver their card and go to the next table. Well, yeah, I mean, it's pretty obvious what you're doing if you do that. But it may take a little longer if you stand there and watch two or three hands and don't leave exactly right after the dealer has delivered their card, you know.
But you'll last longer.
Yeah, I mean, yes.
All right, another question. He says, I had this huge argument with my friend about a no-limit hold'em home game he attended. It was the first time he was invited by a friend, and he really didn't know anyone at this game. He was up $300 in the first hour. He eventually stayed for 4 or 5 hours and ended up being down $200. Afterwards, I asked why he didn't leave when he was winning, and he said he felt guilty being up 300 and wouldn't be invited again if he pulled a hit and run. I then asked, is it okay to leave when you're down 300 in the first hour then? All right, I'm going to try this one first because I'm not a poker player. Home games have special social rules to go along with them. A key factor is that you neglected to discuss whether or not your friend believes he's a favorite in this game. If he is a favorite, playing hit and run is not a good way to keep his welcome. If he's not a favorite, he's better off not being invited again. if he has no idea whether he's a favorite or not, then he's probably not. The quit while you're ahead rule of money management is not one that winning players use. At the one-hour mark, he didn't know what the results of the next 3 to 4 hours were going to be. After the session is totally over, well then yeah, you could say, should have quit at the high point. But while you're playing, you never know where that high point is. Winning gamblers use a rule something like, are you a favorite and playing well? If yes, keep playing. If not, get out of there. Assuming your bankroll isn't threatened, your current score is not really part of that calculus. Richard.
Yeah, I think home games are an entirely different animal, and I think the guy was right that he probably would not be invited back. And usually if I'm playing in a home game, I'm not there because I'm concerned about making the maximum amount of money. I'm there because it's a good time with friends, and I want to spend time with my friends. And so, yeah, trying to lock in a $300 win is just irrelevant to spending the evening, you know, with a group of people I enjoy. So
yes.
And if I am a favorite, well, then if I stay longer in the long run, I'm making more money, not losing money.
Yes, even though there will be times where it goes the other way.
Yeah.
All right, our next one is from somebody who said he had three questions for us, and then he listed all four of them. The first
one. So math is his strong suit.
I guess. The first one was, I wonder if you and Richard think that 6 to 5 blackjack and 000 roulette are here to stay in Las Vegas.
I think to some degree, yeah. I mean, somewhat these things are cyclical. Wynn, you know, a couple of years back went to only double odds on craps. They've now reversed that and gone back to 3, 4, 5. So I think there's some sort of ebb and flow to this, but there will be some casino management who just, you know, believes more is better, and they don't care if revenue goes down as long as the hold percentage goes up. And
yep. All right. Now, 50 or so years ago, when Beat the Dealer came out, casinos changed the rules of blackjack, and the players rejected the game, and the casino bosses were forced to change blackjack back to how it originally was. What's the difference between then and now? And I'm going to try this one first. And that is, back then, players revolted and stopped playing. There doesn't appear to be any revolt these days.
Right, yeah.
So if the players are going to play these stupid games, the casinos are going to keep giving it to them.
Right. And you see people playing 000 roulette. You know, I mean, remember, people who play 00 roulette are giving up like 10 times what the blackjack player who knows basic strategy is giving up.
You know?
So, yeah, if people play it, they'll keep dealing it. What you know, the problem with this is the casino doesn't know about the money they're not earning. That's the problem. They see the money they're earning, but they don't know what they would be earning if they didn't do these things. And there's an interesting experiment going on at the Cromwell where they are paying 3 to 2 on blackjack and have single zero roulette. And the question is, if the Cromwell sees an uptick in revenue from gambling, will it sink into the brains of the people at Caesars Entertainment?
If you believe that, you've been smoking the wrong stuff too much, Richard.
I guess, yeah.
All right. Third question. Why do the two of you think that Macau and Europe accept continual shuffling machines while the United States doesn't?
The United States does, right?
It does. You clearly see them, and I guess you're going to see more of them over time. Casinos have been trending towards making things worse and worse for the intelligent player. That's just another step in that direction.
And actually, I mean, I do think there's a limited life to those because actually I don't think you'll see dealers in another 5 years. I think everything will be electronic and you won't even have dealers in the casinos.
Well, you won't have to tip the machines quite so much, will you?
That's true.
Finally, and this one's all for you, Richard, it's like, what kind of chess openings do you like to play and which chess websites do you use? If you have an answer to this one, Richard, knock yourself out.
Yeah, well, I play on first internet free internet chess server, Fix, F-I-C-S. And, you know, you could send me an email. We didn't need to waste our listeners' time talking about my chess openings.
All right. So let's talk to our guest. Gabby Girl, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you for having me.
We've made you wait to be able to talk to us, and hopefully you enjoy the process. Now, you worked as a private investigator for about 4 years back in the early 80s, starting out when you were under 21. A lot of your work required you to be 21 years of age or older, but you weren't. How did this happen?
Well, I was working at a finance company, and Eddie LaRue, who was a private investigator here in Las Vegas, he still is, has been for over 46 years, noticed that I had a natural ability to not be afraid to speak to people and obtain information I wasn't supposed to have. Between that and my boss at the time, they discussed this over lunch and decided that the best thing for me to do would be to go to work for Eddie in the evenings to perfect those skills. And of course, I was absolutely excited that I was going to be a private investigator.
Wow. So if you can get information out of people that you're not supposed to have, I may want to take you to talk to some casino hosts.
You know, the curiosity can kill the cat there, Richard.
So I experienced this firsthand. Gabby and I went to the Mob Museum, kind of hoping she'd see some pictures on the walls of some of these guys who are no longer with us. And I remember him. Let's talk about him. But before we got to see that, there was this guy at the start, 80 years old. He looks like he could have been a mobster way back when. And Gabby started asking a few questions, and he would answer, and she prompted him with a few more, and he could not stop talking about this. Gabby would say a few words, and he just would go out of his way to tell her everything he knew. So, did you know how to do this before you were a private investigator, or did you perfect it, or what?
It was something that I learned how to do. Is most cases when you're investigating someone or you want to know information, you give them more information about who you are or something of interest, and they automatically want to tell you everything they know. As you know, as I approached that gentleman, I said, "You look like family." And he smiled very sincerely and was ready to acknowledge me as a friend. From there, he started telling me and dropping some very big names in the process. Also clearly advising us the association with Oscar Goodman and the Mob Museum, how it was acquired and different cases that he knew.
It was... She's good, guys. She's good. So what was your first case? This might have been 1980 or so,
1981. Carrie Sage was a child who was 6 years old who was kidnapped in 1978. His father was Saul Sage, who was the owner of Carpet Barn at the time, which was our largest flooring provider in the Las Vegas area. Carrie Sage was a very difficult case, and to this day hasn't been solved. I started working in the evenings with Eddie LaRue following leads. Some of those leads came from psychics and mediums and other methods, not of paper, not of research, not of interviews. And we would follow those leads, whether it was a psychic or a medium having a impression of train tracks and grass and certain road marks.
Was this because the father of the victim wanted to hire you to pursue these types of leads?
Yes. Eddie was one of the largest, or was the main investigator for the Carrie Sage kidnapping. Now, they did arrest a gentleman named Gerald Burgess, and he was tried, but he was acquitted. There wasn't enough information to convict him, but he was the last person to see Carrie Sage, admittedly, on the playground the day he was kidnapped. He also was the person that found the one piece of evidence, which was this shoe. I don't recall whether it was the right or left shoe, but Mr. Burgess was tried and not convicted.
Did you, I mean, if I were in your shoes and the client wanted us to investigate things that, you know, were told to him by a psychic, I don't know. I mean, did that, I mean, to me, that just seems kind of like a big waste of the guy's money.
Well, this was 5 years after the kidnapping. And the only evidence they had was the evidence that was on scene. They'd already had a failed trial. They had already exhausted all the police leads that we had. And you search for answers at the best place you can find some answers. And those answers were coming from psychics and mediums and people of the spiritual persuasion.
But none of those panned out.
None of them did.
Which does not sound like Richard was going to be too surprised at that.
Yeah, I mean...
Well, I understand.
I mean, I guess when you're desperate, right? If you've lost a child, I can see you, you know, it's...
When you're a grieving father, you would want to know, especially when you have financial means,
yeah,
to continually pursue something that can't be solved. To this day, that case is not solved. He has not been found. He's still featured on America Most Wanted and some of the missing children programs that we have today by John Walsh.
So now he'd be 45 or so and might have changed a bit. Okay. Who was Yablonsky?
Joe Yablonsky was the FBI director in Las Vegas, Nevada. He had such a vendetta, and of course any person in the law enforcement would have a vendetta against criminal activity. He had a vendetta against not only the mob and the illegal activity and the racketeering that was happening in this town because of the gaming, the gambling, the skimming, the murders, which I take a deep breath when I say murders, because at this time of my life when I started, I was so naive to that. Joe Yablonsky wanted Oscar Goodman. He did not like the fact that Oscar Goodman could defend these criminals, known murderers and racketeers, allegedly, and get them off of their charges. No matter how hard Yablonsky and the FBI team worked in this town, they couldn't get anything to stick because there was evidence, but not enough evidence. And when you're up against Oscar Goodman, who was one of the best defense attorneys in this country, not city. He made $10,000 a day, and he earned every penny.
How well did you know Oscar?
Oscar was one of our clients. We did a lot of things for Oscar, from private investigating to locating witnesses to serving witnesses with due process to helping him with investigations, to delivering messages, to being there for him for court, to running back and forth to his office, to doing a multitude of administrative things.
So you knew him as Oscar the lawyer, but not a personal relationship?
I really didn't have a personal relationship, but I knew that in the times when we were casually with Mr. Goodman, he was very pleasant. He was very congenial. And when he was taking a lunch break, it was a lunch break. There was no working during lunch. It was to enjoy the meal, to relax, and to decompress before the next
appointment. And have a martini or two.
We didn't have martinis during lunch at that time. I know he's completely famous. I am a Tanqueray fan. I can put it down with the best of them.
But one reason... Now, a lunch in public, you don't know who's in the next booth. So that might have something to do with the fact that no business was done over lunch.
Not in the particular locations that we would eat and frequent with our clients. It wasn't discussed during lunch. But often you could be at a place called Chicago Joe's and you could hear lots of negotiations going on between attorneys and prosecutors, not necessarily witnesses or anything that would be criminally productive.
Chicago Joe's is still open.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's got the best meatball sandwich in the world.
Now, you might have been naive about these guys were killers, but you were close to your father. Surely your father wasn't naive about it. How did he feel about you working one step removed from the mob?
Well, here's his little Catholic girl. very bubbly, very inquisitive, very blonde, very tiny, and very excited when I would come to Sunday dinner and I would tell my traditionally Catholic father that I met someone like Anthony Spilotro and how exciting that was. Or we were investigating the hole in the wall gang and that Oscar Goodman was a wonderful attorney who had made the paper so many times. My father read the paper every day. He was horrified that his little girl thought this was exciting because these were murderers by my father's perception.
Well, your father, anybody's perception. Your father happened to be right in this case.
Yeah. So what was the first time you met Spilotro?
During the investigation, after the Hole in the Wall gang had been arrested, it was a sting operation that was set up by the Metropolitan Police. Gene Smith was very instrumental in that. He was an undercover narcotics officer. He belonged to the SWAT team. He was very instrumental in going after the mob. And the mob actually feared him because he was not afraid of them at all. So they set up a sting at Bertha's, or Bertha's, some people call it Bertha's, and it was supposed to be a $1 million haul. They were to go and cut into the roof.
Wait, we should tell the audience, for those not old enough to remember, what the Hole in the Wall gang was and what Bertha's was.
The Hole in the Wall gang was a group of men allegedly connected to mob or Chicago outfit organizations. They would cut particles out of buildings to avoid wire alarms so that they could rob certain facilities.
Right. They would literally cut a hole in the wall or a hole in the ceiling to go in and rob places.
Or the floor.
Or the floor.
They were nicknamed the Hole in the Wall gang because they were actually copying the old time bank robbers and train robbers in the turn of the century that would cut a hole into a bank to take the safe. That was to avoid anybody seeing them removing this in the middle of the night. The Hole in the Wall gang was arrested on July 4th. And the reason why they chose
in what year?
1981.
Okay.
So when I came in, it was probably 6 months after that where I was part of the defense investigation.
So Oscar Goodman was defending these guys. Was Frank Collada one of the Hole in the Wall gang?
Yes, he was.
Okay.
Oscar was defending Anthony Spilotro because Collada, after all the information that the criminal department had advised on mobster activity, he knew he had no other choice. He was caught. He couldn't do anything about it. So he sang like a canary to get out of it. Our job was to help in the defense investigation while Oscar was representing Anthony Spilotro.
Okay. So what was that very first meeting? I mean, was it at Oscar's office or how did you meet him?
My first meeting was at a place called the Blue Onion. The Blue Onion was at one time a Bob's Big Boy down on Las Vegas Boulevard. It wasn't a candlescent place. It was more like a coffee shop. Several times when I had seen him, I only knew him as the aunt. At that time, I had no idea that the aunt was Anthony Spilotro. He wasn't a very tall, handsome, what I would have perceived at that time to be a lieutenant of a mafia military.
But you learned.
I learned very quickly.
All right, we're going to talk more about Anthony Spilotro next week. We're going to backtrack a little bit. Who was Frank Lefty Rosenthal, and what do you know about him?
Frank Lefty Rosenthal was one of the first people to bring sports betting into the Las Vegas area and the U.S. casinos in 1976. He owned the Stardust, but my exposure to him was much earlier than that because my father took the Sun newspaper, and Frankie wrote a gossip column at that time, which was all about celebrities. Me enjoying the drama of finding out information that I'm not supposed to know, I enjoy reading the column. He was also the first casino operator to bring women to the blackjack floors. In that time, he...
I don't think that's true. I think the Union Plaza was the first one to use women blackjack dealers, and I think they started in about 1970, I think.
I may be incorrect with that, but I
possibly
do know
that... Possibly the first
that...
one on the Strip.
Maybe. Possibly. Maybe. At the Stardust. I know that it doubled their profits for that year. That's how effective it was. Also, Frankie had a little problem with his friends that he associated with, and they bombed his car. When I say they, I have no knowledge of who. I just say they to make it safe.
Do you have any suspicions of people who are no longer alive that you could suspect out loud? Or do you think that's not a good idea?
Well, I'm not exactly sure, but I know that Lefty was a talker. He was during the hearings of the mob when they created the criminal investigation and the government went after them. He was very verbal. He knew lots of people, celebrities. I don't think he was a very well-liked guy because I'm sure that he held the till very close in his own casinos. Although he rubbed elbows and had associations, I have no knowledge of whether he actually paid skim.
Well, the movie Casino is about Lefty Rosenthal, and they make it pretty clear, based on the book by Nicholas Pileggi, I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name. I mean, they make it pretty clear in the movie that it was Spilotro that had his car bombed. Now, I'm sure he didn't plant the bomb himself, but I remember very vividly the night that that happened. Also, just a brief aside.
I love his asides, by the way.
In 1978, I broke in as a blackjack dealer at the Golden Nugget downtown, and one of my regular customers said to me after I'd been there about 8 months, "How come you're not dealing on the Strip?" And I said, "Well, I don't. Everything in Las Vegas is juice. You have to have juice to go work anywhere." And I said, "I don't have any juice." And this was an older woman who was from Las Vegas forever. And she just looked at me like I was an idiot. And she said, "Your father is an attorney in Chicago, and you don't think he knows somebody that can get you a job on the Strip?" And I was like, "Oh, I never thought of that." So I called him. My dad calls me back 3 days later, and he says, "Yeah, I can get you a job on the Strip. Go to the Stardust and talk to this guy named Frank Rosenthal." And I had already been here long enough that I said to my father, "You know what? Thanks anyway. I'm going to go find my own job."
That's a double shot of juice there, Richard.
All right. We're going to talk about Frank Collada turning state's evidence. But before we do that, we're going to take a brief break for some commercials. South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. There are two separate promotions going on in September. First, there's a $600,000 Money Madness promotion, and there are two casino-wide progressives going on at the same time. The big one must be hit between $10,000 and $25,000, and if you're playing when somebody else hits it, you get $25 in free play. The smaller one goes off between $1,000 and $2,500 and hits about 3 times a day. You're eligible for both so long as your card is in and you've played at least $1 in the past 60 seconds. The second monthly promotion is for bottles of moonshine. Play 500 points per week and earn one bottle of City Lights Shine. Max of 2 bottles per week with your choice of 4 different flavors. These bottles are specially labeled to commemorate the inaugural South Point 400 NASCAR race, which was held September 16th. Video poker classes. Semester has ended for the year. We will be starting again in mid-January. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the game. The game of the week is Wheel Poker with Quick Quads. 7 coins per line, where 1 extra coin for the wheel and 1 extra coin for quick quads. The wheel averages 157.5 coins, and you get it for every quad and every quick quad. All right, we are back talking with Gabby Girl. And a few minutes ago, she mentioned Frank Collada was one of Tony Spilotro's lieutenants in the Hole in the Wall gang, and for his own reasons decide to turn state's evidence and squeal on the members of the mob. Was this a big deal?
It was absolutely a big deal. In my young, uneducated mind, who thought that the mafia were pure business and only there to conduct business. And that was part, because when you are a private investigator, you have to be objective. You can't enter into any case that you're doing with an opinion that is any of value, because it will sway your investigation. I come into work the day after Collada turned state evidence, which was down on 3rd Street. And as I'm coming off the freeway at the 95, the buildings are covered with National Guard, FBI, SWAT teams, police. Everything is cordoned around the courthouse. And I had no knowledge, because I didn't read the paper that morning, nor did I watch the news that night. And the sensationalism of all of it was different than the opinion in the position I was working in. My job was to act as an administrator in the defense and the investigator in the defense. So I didn't watch that. I came into work and I said, "Eddie, what's going on downtown?" And he goes, "You silly girl. Collada turned state evidence. He is going to testify against all of them. This whole case may go down. I've already been on the phone with so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. Sit down. Get your paper. Get your book. I got some things for you to do today." And then my list proceeded. That is actually when it all got turned up. Because when it got turned up, Oscar got involved. Now, Tony Spilotro needs to be defended, because he was the enforcer who ordered the robbery. This was all related to the Berthe, or the Berthe's, robbery, and what was set up as a sting operation by the FBI and the Metro Police Department.
And, you know, I read Frank Collada's book, which I
enjoyed, and I'm still hoping to get him on the show, but he's not...
Yeah, I don't know
reachable.
If he's still alive, actually, but because he hasn't been answering anybody.
It has been reported that he's not in good health now.
Yeah, but and I just wanted to say his book is quite entertaining, and the story of that bust and how it happened. I mean, it sounded like, you know, Keystone Cops, and the whole thing just sounded like a cluster.
Exactly.
But yeah.
Well, they tried to pull the robbery off on July 4th, so that with the loudness of the drills and the ladders and the saws, that nobody would notice it, because the 4th of July fireworks would be going off. And they had inside information that the safe was going to have $1 million in it, or jewels. And as it turns out, Metro was all set up. The FBI was all set up. They got into an argument because somebody didn't show up or do what they were told. Anthony was already angry at things going wrong. Collada rushed it, because we got to get this job done. We only have a window of fireworks in Vegas. They're normally at 9 o'clock at night. We have to make this happen. Vegas was a small town then, probably 225,000 people.
Now,
by the way, I should say, at least from Collada's side of the story, he felt pretty confident that Spilotro was going to have him killed, which is why he decided to turn state's evidence.
I'm quite sure he had his pretty strong reasons.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could sleep well at night being confident that the aunt was going to kill me.
Yeah, that might that might have made you a little nervous.
Yeah. Yes.
Now, there was reportedly $1 million reward put on Frank Collada's head after he turned state's evidence. Now, I'm guessing, as a single girl in her early 20s, $1 million, thinking about that, could kind of get your juices going. Did you think about that $1 million at all?
It's not something that I thought about a lot, but the day we were in court handling what was necessary for our investigative roles and duty and standing 10 feet from Mr. Collada as he was taking a drink of water in the water fountain, I had a sudden fantasy flash of how nice it would be to have a stream of poison and how well I could live on that $1 million.
Assuming that nobody saw you do this and you weren't caught or any of those other inconvenient things.
Well, considering the fact that our client was Oscar Goodman, I'm sure that I would have a little hand up getting out of that problem. Certainly could afford him representing me at $10,000 a day.
Well, yeah, if they paid you the $1 million first, yes.
I'm far too cute and innocent to actually be arrested or be suspected as a criminal.
Okay. Well, I know part of that is definitely true. Now, Eddie LaRue, your boss, sometimes he would offer something like $300 to if you could serve the subpoena before Monday morning. Was that kind of incentive ever get your juices going?
Oh, are you kidding? My rent was $250. $300 was in the black, $50. And that would only take me an hour with some creative thinking, because when those bonuses were offered, they were usually on cases that no one else could get close to a particular person to prove or present legal process, whether it was divorce or lawsuit. These people had been evading service for some time. When those bonuses came, my creativity went to work.
So there was one you mentioned when we were at the Mob Museum about this guy named Nasser, I think. Do you remember that one?
Yes, I do. Nasser was a son of a Lebanese ambassador, and he was a playboy in this town, but he was married. He was extremely disappointed that his wife only bared him girls at that point.
The nerve of her.
Oh. There were so many dramas involved about alleged fires, different things. And that bonus came if I could get Nasser served that weekend. The papers were about to expire, and he needed to be served. Nasser lived on the Las Vegas Country Club in a private home.
So this is right behind what's the Westgate now, would have been the Las Vegas Hilton then, or maybe the International.
Behind the Las Vegas Hilton.
Yes.
Where his brother, Elias, had a medical office. Uh-huh. Elias Ghanem was a doctor to the stars here in Las Vegas, as well to the Boxing Commission.
Uh-huh. We're going to talk a little bit about the Boxing Commission next week. But so Nasser has his home on the golf course. So how did you get him served?
Well, he was a player, and he was kind of a handsome man, and he loved women, particularly blonde women. And I was blonde, as I still am, and I came up with the idea that if I jumped his wall with a Cosmopolitan in my hand, Cosmopolitan magazine, and a polka dot bikini, and laid in his backyard as if I was an overdrunk, overzealous young woman from the night before, I could get close enough to serve him.
Uh-huh. Well, I'm guessing, based on evidence 30 years later, that a polka dot bikini would look pretty good on you back then.
Absolutely.
So
how did this work? You're in a bikini, you drive onto the golf course. How did you get to his house and jump his fence in a bikini?
First of all, part of private investigating is knowing all the records and knowing where's where and who's who and who owns what. So I get his address, I get the gate to the code from our client or from their attorney, and I decide to go there at 8:30 on a Sunday morning and jump the wall and act like I was just one of the girls left over from the night before, reading a Cosmopolitan. As Nasser came up in the morning, he always had coffee at the pool. So he came out in a robe with his coffee and a newspaper, looked at me, put his hands up like, what the are you doing here? I said, I'm just reading. How are you, sir? Acting as if it was a public pool.
Okay, so how did this conversation go on from then? Did he think his ship had come in, or did he think you ought to get the hell out of there?
He took a couple sips of his coffee, and then he moved closer to me to flirt around, which I suspected that he would.
Uh-huh. So how close did he get? How close does he have to get to serve a subpoena?
Well, we didn't have intimate relationship, but he did sit next to me, and he started talking, and I had the papers folded in my Cosmopolitan magazine.
Of course.
And as soon as he had relaxed enough to sit back and have a little cocky attitude and a little flirt with me, I pulled the papers out. I threw them at his feet. I jumped the fence because I needed to leave immediately.
I would guess.
I might have been in a little of danger from his anger and his temperament. And I jumped the fence and sped off.
Do you announce you're served, or do you have to announce anything when you throw him at his feet, or what's the rule on that?
I announce that he has been served. He does not need to know my name. I sign the affidavit when I return, and it's recorded with the district court.
Uh-huh.
And does he need to touch them, or as long as they're next to him, that's enough?
They have to touch the person's body.
Ah. So as long as you hit him in the feet?
I threw him at his feet. I had to get away. So that was the right hand to the feet and left hand over the fence.
You don't know if he has a bodyguard who would restrain you or weapons or anything.
Once he's been served, I mean, what's the point in doing anything to her, right? I mean,
I don't know that he's thinking right at that particular moment.
Yeah. Everybody parties late until the morning on a Saturday night in Las Vegas, and he was one of that type. Yeah. He could have just seen the sun come up, gone in and taken a shower, and decided to have his paper before he went to sleep.
All right. Sometimes, mob-related or not, you would be hired to check out a particular woman, perhaps a wife or girlfriend of somebody who thought she might be cheating on him. When you got those assignments, what type of thing did you do?
We did multiple car surveillance. We would often look at the person's schedule, how their days went, what time of day they would disappear, how long they would be gone, and we would run dual surveillance. Interesting, we've done surveillance on some very important people, judges, and different people of power and authority in this town with an element of success and a degree of financial wealth. And we would follow them and find out who they were with. And of course, that always included pictures, research, and we'd usually do it for 3 to 5 days to establish a pattern in a relationship.
Would you be better at getting close to these people than some of your coworkers?
Absolutely.
So you would try to make contact with them to get information as opposed to just surveilling them and not being noticed?
Yes, because I looked like I was 15, 16 years old. So if I got a flat tire at someone's home and I needed to enter the home to prove that someone was inside the home, I would get a flat tire or a broken down battery and I'd need to use their phone. Because at that time, we didn't have cell phones that were smaller than a brick. And our private investigating cars had dial-up phones in them.
Uh-huh.
Two pair of shorts goes a long way in this hot city.
I'm a 70-year-old man. I have no idea what you're talking about. We've been talking to Gabby Girl. We're going to have her back on next week. She's going to go more into detail on Tony Spilotro and some of her other shenanigans that she pulled way back when, and she's a private investigator. Gabby, this has been fun. I'm looking forward to next week's talk, too.
Thank you for having me, Bob and Richard.
Richard, thank you. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.